This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Coming up, military veterans from the Pacific turn to the courts in their search for justice and fairness from the UK government. As Melbourne wrestles with a coronavirus spike, would-be seasonal workers from Solomon Islands put their plans to return to Australia on hold. And can the Australian government be persuaded to continue its support for the Pacific Island Food Revolution, the TV show with a big message to share about healthy eating and cutting the rates of NCDs? Those stories to come, but first, with the United States under fire for hoarding almost all of the world's supply of remdesivir, the only drug licensed so far to treat COVID-19, the World Health Organization's plan to purchase and share 2 billion doses of coronavirus vaccines has come into sharp focus. When they become available, the aim is to distribute vaccines to high-risk populations, including countries with fragile health systems like the Pacific Islands. The strategy has the backing of the Deputy Director of the Burnett Medical Research Institute in Australia, who says the absence of COVID-19 in large parts of the Pacific up to now is largely down to luck. And Associate Professor David Anderson is warning island nations which are free of the virus for now must not presume that will always be the case, because the COVID-19 threat may be with us for the next 10 years. The scramble to find a vaccine for COVID-19 and drugs to treat those worst affected by infection is intense. Right now, there are 16 vaccines in clinical trials and at least another 125 in earlier stages of development. When any of those vaccines become available, the WHO wants to ensure all countries have access to them. And so it's joined forces with the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, to devise an $18.1 billion US dollar plan to buy and share 9 of the candidate vaccines. As no one knows which vaccines will be successful, purchasing shares in a pool to be known as the COVAX facility will broaden a country's chances of having access to those that do work. It's a strategy that has the support of Associate Professor David Anderson, the Burnett Institute's Deputy Director.
Otherwise, we will end up with a handful of countries who have first rights to the vaccines that prove to be effective, and everyone else scrabbles for the leftovers. And that is not going to be effective for a global pandemic, because if countries want to reopen their borders, get their societies back to normal, we need to control this worldwide, not just on a country-by-country basis.
But for the WHO's plan to work, it will require commitments from high and upper middle-income countries to purchase up to 950 million doses of vaccine. And so Washington's go-it-alone approach on remdesivir has caused outrage in the medical community, with Martin Landry, Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology at the University of Oxford, among those leading the criticism.
COVID is a global problem with millions of patients affected worldwide. Those patients need access to proven treatments. For one country to dominate the access to a single treatment is beyond unfortunate.
The US might end up with rights to a vaccine that would better suit the developing world because it's more stable for shipping to remote areas, for example. Someone else might develop a vaccine that's particularly good for elderly populations, and high-income countries have a higher proportion of elderly people than low- and middle-income countries. So we will get much better return from the vaccines that we might end up with if we have the ability to share them equitably around the world and most effectively around the world.
With small economies and basic health systems, Dr. Anderson says Pacific Island countries will rely on international support to get access to vaccines, and then need to encourage a potentially reluctant population to get immunised.
We can't underestimate the amount of effort that is going to be required to work out how best to deliver these vaccines to the vulnerable populations in many of the countries of the world, because we haven't done this before. We haven't tried to deliver a vaccine to healthcare workers and at-risk populations in these countries at any great scale. Flu vaccine is not widely used in many of the countries that will need the COVID-19 vaccine. So we're going to have to work out how to deliver it to those countries, as well as actually having the vaccine doses available.
While many of the island nations are COVID-19 free so far, Dr. Anderson says we only need to look at recent history to recognise how quickly that situation can change.
The example of measles in Samoa last year shows that it's good luck that they have not had introductions of COVID-19. And if they don't have ongoing transmission, they would be slightly lower priority, but it will get there eventually. And as the spread of measles in Samoa when their vaccine coverage had dropped showed dramatically, there is no reason that a respiratory infection won't take hold in those communities. There's nothing special about the Pacific Islands that will stop that happening once it's introduced.
And the World Health Organization's regional director for the Western Pacific, Dr. Takeshi Kasai, is acutely aware that the islands are still at high risk.
Most Pacific islands have yet to report a single case, but there is really no room for complacency. There is still plenty of space for the virus to spread in this region. In this interconnected world, as long as the virus is circulating somewhere, no country is safe. We must continue responding to the current situations and preparing every corner of every country for the possibility of large-scale community transmission.
The fear is, in a country like Papua New Guinea, for example, that the small number of COVID-19 cases confirmed so far may actually be shielding a bigger reality. And Associate Professor Anderson and his team at Burnet are working on broader solutions.
My lab is leading in developing improved diagnostic tests that would be suitable for a low prevalence and resource-poor setting like Papua New Guinea so that we can detect any new infections. But the other, perhaps even more critical aspect of the work that we're doing is surveillance, particularly on the border with Papua province. That's where the virus is likely to enter, looking at all causes of respiratory diseases and fevers more generally. That surveillance is going to be increasingly important.
At the WHO, Dr. Kasai says the pandemic has reached a critical point and Pacific Island nations need to be extra vigilant.
We are now at the decisive moment and we must keep preparing for further surges of the virus, so that together we make our way to a better future.
Exactly what that better future may look like is a matter for debate. But at the Burnet Institute, David Anderson says COVID-19 will have to be factored into every Pacific Island country's health plans for a long time to come.
I don't see an end to it, even with a vaccine, for at least 10 years. We should remember that our most recent pandemic that has been really deadly was HIV. And we don't have a vaccine. And while it's largely under control in many parts of the world, it is only because of continued efforts that we are making progress there. And I think that COVID-19 will be the same. If we have good vaccines, good diagnostics, hopefully some better antivirals for people who do end up getting severe illness, we'll be able to cope with COVID-19, and the new normal won't be that different to our old normal. But I don't think we'll return to a time when we can just forget about COVID-19.
Associate Professor David Anderson, Deputy Director of the Burnet Institute in Melbourne. Now, pressure is mounting on the UK government to scrap its controversial immigration policy for veterans, with some saying it punishes foreign-born soldiers unfairly. Eight Fijian veterans have begun legal proceedings against the British Home Office and the Ministry of Defence, claiming they were not given the correct guidance on how to settle in the UK despite decades of service. Priyanka Srinivasan reports.
For 8 years, Mary Walisi Langilangi from Fiji served in the Royal British Army.
I was a postal and courier operator.
She travelled the world, working in Germany, Iraq, Kosovo. Her job was to monitor all mail coming in and out of the army.
Not just that, but all the confidential, top-secret, secret cryptos, eh?
When she finished her service in 2008, her plan was to find a job and settle in the UK with her family.
My hopes was high because of due to my husband who was still serving at that time. And not just that, but on the top of that, I'm a serving soldier as well.
But it was only when she applied for a job in the UK that she found out she didn't have the right documents to work or even stay in the country.
I was so embarrassed when they said, oh, did you know that you're not supposed, do you know that you, that the visa, that the thing that you have doesn't qualify you to stay here? And I was like, what?
Miss Langilangi said she applied for an extension of a visa, but she was told she had missed the two-year deadline for renewal after her service and would have to leave the UK immediately. Miss Langilangi says she was never told about that procedure.
Normally, when you served, because I know when I was recruited here in Fiji, I was told that after 4 years, while we served, the army will do our papers for us. But unfortunately, it didn't happen.
And though Ms. Lungilungi says she's happy to be back in Fiji, even though her daughter is now in the UK, others are pushing for change. 8 former Fijian service members are suing the UK government, saying they were never told about how to remain legally in the country. Like Ms. Lungilungi, many assumed the process was automatic.
We are asking the UK government to recognise the service of these men and women.
Isita Tuyamanu is the co-founder of the Commonwealth of Neglected Veterans and is helping to coordinate the case against the UK government.
They have paid for the ultimate sacrifice. They have gone out on the front line. Their families has also suffered. They are unique enough to be able to get citizenship. They should get automatic citizenship like they do with countries like Australia, the US and France.
Most British service members are eligible for UK citizenship once they are discharged from the army, if they served at least 4 years. But the process can be expensive. According to the Royal British Legion, a former service member with 2 children and a partner can expect to pay almost £10,000 or $17,000 to stay in the UK. Ms. Tuyamanu says this isn't fair.
The British Army comes to Fiji. They advertise, join the army, travel the world. Yes, that is lovely. And, you know, that is why a lot of people come to join the British Army, because there are prospects of opportunities for them. It opens up doors. But what people do not realize is that these recruits spend thousands of pounds and their families. So it's the visa fees that they have to pay for and the airfares. And some of them, you know, they get themselves into debt before even coming to join the British Army.
And for some, the inability to stay in the UK can have life-threatening impacts.
Taitusi Ratuvauvo is his name, facing the £30,000 hospital bill.
Commonwealth-born British Army veteran says he feels hurt and let down.
One of the veterans was even forced to pay a $55,000 hospital bill.
Taitutsi Ratuvauvau, a British Army veteran from Fiji, made international headlines earlier this year when he was forced to turn to charity to pay for an almost $50,000 emergency procedure to remove a tumour from his brain. For UK citizens, that cost would have been free through their National Health Service. Mr. Ratuvauvau is one of the 8 service members who launched legal action against the Home Office and Ministry of Defence earlier this year. Ms. Tuyamanu says his case reveals the systemic failures of the UK Defence Force's recruitment.
So Taitusi came out in a country that is foreign to him and his family. No links whatsoever. They were told, you need to sort yourself out, because Taitusi was told. He was given 28 days to sort himself out. Where would he get the money from? So there is a lot of cost involved in joining the British Army. It's not as lucrative as what they advertise.
In a statement to Pacific Beat, a UK government spokesperson has said it works closely with foreign and Commonwealth recruits to make sure they are aware of how they and their families can attain settlement in the UK and the costs involved. The spokesperson also said that the UK government offers financial advice, savings packages and loans to help personnel pay for visa costs should they wish to settle in the UK. Ms. Tuyamanu says this isn't enough.
Why is it that the UK government cannot recognise the services of the Commonwealth community? Because the only thing and the fair thing to do is to do right by these men and women and give them what they've been crying for years. Abolish the visa fees policy.
That's the co-founder of the Commonwealth of Neglected Veterans Organisation, Isita Tuyamanu, and the reporter there was Priyanka Srinivasan. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review on ABC Radio Australia. The spike in COVID-19 case numbers in Melbourne is not good news for those Pacific Islanders who are planning to travel to Australia for work at the first opportunity. In Solomon Islands, income from seasonal work has changed lives and helped families to build new homes and start small businesses. So many of those who have already had the experience of taking up a job in Australia are keen to return. But right now, as Evan Wasuka reports from Honiara, all plans are very much up in the air.
It may be fun time for her kids, but nearby, Sherilyn Ara is knee-deep in water, collecting watercress to sell at the market.
Me clean him, said lo water, I clean it in the water, take out its roots like this, parcel it, and that's
$10.
It's hard work, and for a long time this was the sole source of income for her family. But last year, the 39-year-old left her four children behind to join the Pacific Seasonal Workers Program, which provides jobs on Australian farms.
When I came back, what I did was I built a house. I built a chicken house. Then I bought a car. That car I used as a taxi.
She calls it a blessing because with her income from Australia, she was able to invest in small businesses and earn more than ever before. A canteen to sell basic food like sugar and tea to her neighbours is being built. And across the road, the frame of a three-bedroom house stands.
We've stopped building because we've done as much as we can with the money we have. So I hope with my second, it'll be okay and I can complete the house.
On the beachfront at Kakabona village, Frida Sikwai also has big plans.
I want to finish building a house for my kids, then I want to develop this beach as a picnic area for people to come visit.
Frida is a single mother of four with two tours of Australia under her belt. She says seasonal work has turned her life around.
It's been 2 years since my husband left. This seasonal work has really helped me. It's made life a bit easier, and now I can plan ahead for my children's future.
She's put her money into a taxi and added an extension to her house, which she rents out as a shop. Frida and Sherilene were supposed to return to Mildura in May.
Australia's borders will close this evening with only Australian citizens and residents allowed into the country.
Now the prospect of work is uncertain and their plans are up in the air.
We only had 1 hour to pack up, threw our clothes inside, carry on and we left. We took a flight in Darwin, slept in Brisbane, took a motel and slept there. The next day we were in the Solomons. 17 of us flew here on a Wednesday. On Friday, flights to Solomon Islands were cancelled.
On Wednesday, Friday, flight to Solo cancelled.
Dalton Hala is back at Kakabona village, but construction work on his new home has come to a standstill as he tries to ration his money. He's eager to get back to work and says Australia should recognise that Solomon Islands is COVID-19 free.
If we are to be sent back, we should go through medical checks here. We don't have any cases, but we have to go through Australian government. They're strict about medicals. But it's a normal part of our work, this test.
But opinion over what to do next is mixed. Sherilene is terrified at the thought of catching COVID-19 and says they should only travel when it's safe to do so.
I don't think they should allow us to travel while coronavirus is still there, in case someone brings it back here and then we'll get sick too. So it's best to stop travel.
As they wait for advice, Dalton says the lack of income is starting to affect them.
When we meet our friends, we talk about we need to go back because we don't have money. Our plans, like our house, have stopped. We need to go back and earn money.
As for Sherilene, she's once again collecting watercress and selling betel nut and food on her street. While she waits for the borders to be reopened, she's looking at other ways to make ends meet.
That's Evan Wasuka reporting from Honiara. Finally, it was meant to grab people's attention and put island food on the map, but the TV show Pacific Island Food Revolution was also a launch platform for behaviour change in the way islanders eat. And it proved highly popular, with one series already shown internationally and another about to be broadcast. But now there is a problem: finance. The Innovation Exchange at Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, in partnership with the New Zealand government, underwrote the project from the start, but Canberra's role has run its course. And Robert Oliver, the international chef who founded the Pacific Island Food Revolution, concedes that his organisation may have failed so far to get its wider message across to donors.
Imagine representing your country in the kitchen.
Oh my goodness, no.
This is no simple deal.
Cooking for expert judges.
I can't believe it's her.
The jittery that Her Royal Highness is right next to us.
This year, teams from around the Pacific...
Local food culture is very important. It's our identity.
...are ready to start a revolution.
We're asking. We're in the process of asking and redefining our value proposition, and we hope that we can represent to them successfully. At this point, it's no, but the door is absolutely not closed. And I note that the Australian desire for media content in the Pacific, the free-to-air TV initiative that came out of the Department of Foreign Affairs, which was about Brand Australia being broadcast into the Pacific, and we are a part of that. I was surprised we weren't mentioned in that because we are so overtly Pacific relatable to and addressing a real issue in the Pacific, but we are with that, so that's good too.
You are, but in some senses you're not, are you? Because $17 million has been put into that initiative. At the moment, you're not getting any more money from Australia, and yet that TV package includes the likes of MasterChef, My Kitchen Rules, not really the kind of programme that you want to put out, because as you say, your programme comes with a message.
Yeah, and also our programme is Pacific. Pacific people see themselves in ours. Listen, I'm from the MasterChef MKR world. That was how this idea originally began. I don't know that promoting Brand Australia through that is going to elicit that diplomatic feel towards it from everyday Pacific people to everyday Australians, because it's like putting another world on top of an existing world, whereas we are that Pacific world already. I'm the only foreigner in the show, and the show is populated with absolutely extraordinary Pacific people.
Pacific Island cooks will compete head-to-head.
I need to show the judges something different we never seen before.
Ministers' wives are in it to win it.
Fijian foodies.
We're ready to take on this challenge.
We'll show you how easy it is to eat well.
You've had the pilot. You've had the first series. I believe the second series is in the can and ready to roll, I think, later this month.
That's right.
It's what happens after that, I guess, is the problem now. How do you keep the show and the initiative alive?
Absolutely. And we are struggling with that as a team. And we are hoping that we can still find a home with the Australian government. And it may be about how we define ourselves and how we present ourselves. I want to point out that we are not just a television show, but we're a campaign. And we're a campaign similar to an anti-smoking campaign or a seatbelt campaign. And they took a long time. Also, they took a lot of investment. And we're competing in the food space with the likes of Coca-Cola and the big processed food brands who have a much bigger budget than us. So we want to be as committed as them. I don't think we'll require that level of budget because we're telling the story in a very different way that's going right into Pacific people's homes with Pacific people telling that story themselves. But it does raise the question of, well, who's actually committed?
How would you describe the feedback that you've had from the project overall? Clearly, the TV series is the flagship, if you like, but everything else that's associated with it, what sort of feedback have you had?
Terrific feedback. And because it's new, we learn as we go here. We have a large social media associated product, much more than regular TV show has. We also record all our recipes and publish them for people to use, which other shows never do, because recipes, of course, are tools to good eating. And it's also the soft effect. The whole kaupapa behind Pacific Island Food Revolution is that if people were eating their original foods, their original cuisine, their original cultural food, albeit in new ways, but the foundation, they wouldn't be sick. We wouldn't have an NCD crisis where 84% of Fijians today have diabetes. That simply would not exist. These are very new numbers. So it's not just that the recipes or the TV show or the social media or the partnerships we're now developing with other organizations on the ground to do kind of community activities. It's that general sense of, wow, this is our culture. We are our own solution. That makes people feel great. And you know what? It's true. It's anchored in truth. It's not promo marketing. It's not a spin. It's the real deal.
In the biggest television cooking competition the Pacific has ever seen. Whose food will reign supreme?
If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
Pacific Island Food Revolution.
And Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade have sent us a statement saying they are very pleased to be associated with this television series, which encourages healthy eating through a celebration of Pacific ingredients, culture and knowledge. But the department has offered no clarification on the important question of future funding. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. You can listen to the programme on demand by subscribing to our podcast, and you can also check out past editions on our website. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.